Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 16th of March, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. Well, a little bit chilly here in Plymouth, but not to worry. I'd like to say thank you very much to the people who attended the UK Column meeting in the George Hotel, Plimpton, last night. Really great to see you all. And a big thank you to people who travelled. So if you came up from Cornwall, thank you very much.
Or the Isle of Wight for that.
The Isle of Wight, indeed, and indeed Germany. So great to see you all, and a very enjoyable evening.
Okay, well, it's official. The Queen has just signed the Brexit Bill into law. So says the fake news story from the Daily Mirror. Why am I saying it's a fake news story? Well, of course, she doesn't sign anything anymore. there's no actual signature goes on anything. But aside from that, the implication is that this photograph of the Queen getting dressed up in her nice blue hat and signing something is the Brexit bill, which of course it isn't. So it's a complete piece of propaganda, this. But I was mildly amused, Brian, that the caption on the image says the Queen will have singed the Article 50 bill this morning.
Well, if she wanted to singe it, we could have given her a lighter to do a proper job, couldn't we?
Well, we could have done.
Yeah. I wonder whether she signed her role away as sovereign under mediatisation with a pen. Did she actually sign something, or she just did that quietly in a little backroom discussion?
Took the money and ran.
Treason behind closed doors. Well, the good news is, of course, we're not leaving the European Union. Brexit is a scam, and UK Column has continued to say so from the very beginning. But maybe things are even worse north of the border. Yesterday, I felt the need to tweet out this. We've got a Scottish Independence Party, which is offering the Scottish nation independence as a vassal state of the German-run European Union, which is already rioting. That's quite a future, isn't it, for Scotland? Let's become independent as a vassal state of the EU within a regime which is already falling apart and rioting. And I had to put the little bit of the caption in there, of course, which was Nippy and her flick. I think this is probably pretty accurate, actually, Mike.
Quite possibly.
Maybe it's a love affair.
Who knows? Well, interesting piece of news this morning. No more nepotism to be allowed in the Houses of Parliament, Brian.
That's good. That is good.
Yes. So this is the Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority, who are clearly extremely concerned about what's going on in France with Monsieur Fillon. And they've decided that MPs will no longer be allowed to employ their spouses, their relatives, or in fact, any business associates. So any member of staff who, for example, might begin a relationship with an MP while they're working for them would have to resign their position within 2 years of them beginning that relationship.
Surely you're not suggesting that people working for MPs have relationships with them, Mike?
No, I don't think so. I think it's much more sordid than that. But anyway, that particular aspect of it is very unlikely to happen. But certainly from the election in 2020, no wives, daughters, sons or business associates will be allowed to work for MPs in their private offices.
So will this be a problem for local MPs Gary Streeter and Johnny Mercer? I may be mistaken, but I thought that at one stage they were using spouses to help support them.
Well, there's no mention of hedgehogs, so I don't think Oliver Caldwell's going to have a problem.
No, he'll be okay with Tiggy Winkle.
Yes. Okay, so here we go. Rusi. Rusi has more serious subjects now. Rusi has published this report, Disrupting Human Trafficking, the Role of Financial Institutions. And what they're saying is it's estimated that each year across the globe, 20.9 million people are trafficked for forced labour and sexual exploitation. In the EU and developed countries, trafficking in human beings reaps annual profits of $46.9 billion. In the UK alone, thousands of people are exploited, not just in illegal operations, but also within legitimate business settings, ranging from agriculture and factories to nail bars and car washes. As this report will reveal, banks and other financial service providers are increasingly seeking to address this gap by assessing the services they source and the clients they fund and attempting to apply their transaction monitoring and data analytic capabilities to support the pressing need for improved evidence that could boost prosecutions. So I'm just going to say, what a load of nonsense, because, of course, this people trafficking the business model has become very similar to the business model of drug trafficking. The financial system absolutely at the heart of the drugs trafficking business globally, and I would argue at the heart of people trafficking business as well. So this is attempting to put a bit of veneer, suggesting that the banks are going to do anything about this, is attempting to put a bit of veneer on a pretty dirty business. Well, Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary, was speaking to Roosie yesterday on this. She said that she was delighted to be at Roosie at the launch of Roosie's new report into the role financial institutions can play in tackling modern slavery. 200 years ago, Britain abolished the slave trade and the British Navy set out to eradicate slavery overseas. And yet there are currently 10 to 13,000 people enslaved in Britain and an estimated 45.8 million victims of modern slavery worldwide. So let's just consider that 10,000 to 13,000 people enslaved in Britain. And what is she doing about it?
Well, absolutely nothing.
Indeed. And, so how could she stand up there with a straight face and without any embarrassment and acknowledge that statistic?
Because she's a J.P. Morgan girl, isn't she? I think her former professional life was J.P. Morgan.
Okay, so she went on to say, as Home Secretary, she's determined to do all she can to protect and support victims of this horrible crime and to bring perpetrators to justice. So undoubtedly then she has an answer to the question about the missing Syrian children that went missing out of care in the UK. She'll know exactly where they are and she'll have prosecuted the people responsible.
Well, of course she hasn't. She hasn't replied to any emails on that subject. And that's why we've got Melanie Shaw still in prison, to make sure that Melanie's evidence doesn't help convict any politicians of child abuse.
Right. So she went on to say that in 2015, the government introduced the World Leading Modern Slavery Act. We gave law enforcement agencies new powers to tackle modern slavery. We introduced maximum life sentences for perpetrators and we enhanced the protections available for victims. So no doubt the courts are absolutely jam-packed full of people being prosecuted for this crime.
No.
But as the Roosie paper published today sets out, human trafficking and other forms of slavery continue to exist because they are profitable business models and they're seen as relatively low risk by criminal groups. The International Labour Organization estimates that the trade in human beings generates approximately an enormous $150 billion profit a year. So she wasn't quite sure. They said $46.9 billion. She says $150 billion. So, but in any case, it's a huge number. And then she went on to discuss money laundering and how they're going to deal with it via money laundering legislation. Well, that's all very coincidental, because today Simon Kirby has launched the results of the National Risk Assessment on Money Laundering and Terrorist Financing and found that the effectiveness of the supervisors in the UK is inconsistent. What do I mean by supervisors? Well, there are a whole bunch of supervisory organisations. They're normally business-related organisations that are supposed to provide a supervisory role on the issue of money laundering. So in order to fix this problem, they are now going to create the Office for Professional Body Anti-Money Laundering Supervision.
I've got to chuckle slightly, Mike, because we're back in Alice in Wonderland.
Totally. So the Office for Professional Body Anti-Money Laundering Supervision is expected to supervise the work currently done by 25 supervisory organisations. So there's going to be a supervisor for the supervisors, and that's bound to improve matters, Brian. It's going to be housed within the Financial Conduct Authority, which, of course, does so much good work to make sure that the banks aren't involved in drug dealing or people trafficking. And it's going to work within the Financial Conduct Authority's existing governance arrangements. And it's going to be funded through a new fee on those 25 supervisory organisations, so they're going to pay to be supervised. Well, Simon Kirby said the government has already done much more than any previous government to tackle the threat of money laundering and terrorist financing. Isn't it the government that's financing terrorism?
It is.
Yes. Okay, but they're doing much more to prevent that through money laundering, including the setting up of the Panama Papers Task Force, hosting the London Anti-Corruption Summit in May last year, and recovering a record £255 million. So let me understand this. Amber Rudd says $150 billion. What's that, about £100 billion profit made by people trafficking, and they've recovered £255 million.
Well, that's brilliant, isn't it?
Right, so that's surely just called the cost of doing business, is it not? But much more can be done, he said. The new money laundering regulations and the new Office for Professional Body Supervision will bring the UK's anti-money laundering regime into line with the latest international standards and ensure consistently high standards of supervision across all sectors, sending a strong message that money laundering and terrorist financing should not and will not be tolerated. Well, I would agree with that. It should not be and it will not be tolerated, and the British government should simply resign en masse at this point until that issue is resolved.
Indeed, and I'll say we're working on that. We'll be talking about the Nottingham moot shortly.
Okay, here is the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, and he was having a bit of a mank yesterday about Syria. He said that the entire conflict in Syria, this immense tidal wave of bloodshed and atrocity, began with torture. He said that as the protests in 2011 swelled, the government attacked and waged war on its own people, spawning rebel movements, fueling violent extremists and setting the stage for a regional and proxy war. He said today, in a sense, the entire country has become a torture chamber, a place of savage horror and absolute injustice. As the conflict nears its seventh year, this is the worst man-made disaster in the world has ever seen since World War II. The desperate appeals of people of Aleppo last year had little or no impact on the global leaders whose influence could help bring about an end to the fighting. And so he went on. Well, this engendered quite a reaction from the Russian side, and hardly surprising. I have to say I agree with everything that Maria Zakharova said. She's the Russian Foreign Affairs spokeswoman. She said, we have taken note of the statements by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights on the 14th of March at a high-level thematic discussion on Syria at the 34th session of the UN Human Rights Council. Having appropriated the role of international arbiter, the High Commissioner claims that the situation in Syria is the worst man-made disaster since the Second World War, that the entire country has become a torture chamber. She said, we have first-hand experience of attempts to rewrite history to suit the political situation of the moment. This phenomenon is characteristic of many Western countries. The High Commissioner is, in effect, trying to do the same thing, blame the Damascus authorities for fueling the war in Syria. According to him, vetoes at the UN Security Council have repeatedly pushed back hope for an end to the war. Meanwhile, he turns a blind eye to the fact that right from the start, this conflict was fomented and fueled by outsized forces. He does not use the term terrorism at all, and tries to portray the terrorists as victims of circumstance, which is completely unacceptable. She went on to highlight the fact that he basically ignored the situation with Yemen. She said it's regrettable that the Yemen conflict, as well as the situation in a number of other countries requiring urgent attention, in particular around Mosul in Iraq, for some reason drops off the High Commissioner's radar. So she had very strong words for this, and he merely pushing forward the sort of policy agenda of the West for regime change and just lying through his teeth, really.
They are absolutely desperate. I think we're going to see in just a moment that the establishment, the world establishment, seems to have dug itself a very big hole.
Absolutely. Now, the Guardian here highlighting Save the Children Fund, the headline is Yemen at point of no return as conflict leaves about 7 million close to famine. Now, of course, Human Rights Ambassador, whatever he is.
High Commissioner.
High Commissioner, thank you. He didn't mention Yemen, but here we go. Yemen at the point of no return. This is aid agencies, mainly Save the Children, warning that Yemen at the point of no return, after new figures released by the UN indicated 17 million people are facing severe flood insecurity and will fall prey to famine without urgent humanitarian assistance. 6.8 million people deemed to be in a state of emergency. And of course, what's driving this? Well, more proxy warfare, this time Saudi Arabia bombing these people to bits and mainly bombing their infrastructure to bits. And of course, Yemen always been a food importer. And with they're basically unable to import food through ports which don't function at the moment.
And weapons and munitions being supplied principally by the UK and the USA.
Yes. So, you know, this war continues to go on, continues to be vastly underreported, people continuing to suffer. And of course, it's our allies, sponsored by the United Kingdom and the United States, that are causing the problem.
Yeah, horrific.
Yeah.
Well, credit where it's due. And one of our viewers picked us up for something I said yesterday. So we're going to say wise words from UK column viewer. And this is what it was all about. The person says, just a suggestion, when you mentioned that people should search for more information on a given subject, please don't suggest listeners Google for the info. The term Google, when used to mean searching, is becoming much like Hoover, which has become synonymous as a description for a vacuum cleaner. But this link must be broken down. As I'm sure you know, Google regularly censors and controls search results to manipulate the ability of people to learn, and in my opinion, should not be given any airtime. Using Google will often not result in a comprehensive search result. So that was pretty direct. We take that one on the chin. Of course, you're right, and how right you were. Let's see. I should have just brought this in on the bottom. So there we go. Strike through. Let's bring on BBC fake news, because the BBC is panicking because that terrible fake news, social fake news, of course, has put the whole of the French elections at risk. But luckily, we have £3.65 billion of British state propaganda machine called BBC News and BBC Reality Check. And here's the headline, fake news, five French election stories debunked. I felt so relieved to know that the BBC was busy debunking. So let's have a look at these very frightening stories. We've got Emmanuel Macron's presidential campaign is financed by Saudi Arabia. The BBC's been able to prove that that is just not true, Mike.
Right.
So that's good. They've been able to prove that the French state is not going to spend 100 million euros buying hotels to house migrants. That was a terribly untrue story. Luckily, the BBC has been able to debunk that. Somebody put up a map that showed recent violence across France. Well, that was incorrect because this map is a few years old. There is violence in France and has been for some time, but the BBC has been able to debunk the map as being recent. We've got this one. The French state is replacing Christian public holidays with Muslim and Jewish holidays. That, of course, is outrageous fake news. And this one here I liked a lot because it's got a little cartoon. Marine Le Pen criticised the Masha and the Bear cartoon because the little girl in the story wears a veil. Well, that's pretty good as well because the BBC has debunked that. So these five stories, dangerous to the whole of the French elections. The French public are so immature that their whole opinion was going to be swung by.
And they can't work it out for themselves.
No. So let's follow through. Because when you read this article, it says the BBC was working in collaboration with Crosscheck. So I thought we'd better do a little bit of work on that. And here we've got Crosscheck is a collaborative journalism project that brings together newsrooms across France and beyond to accurately report false, misleading and confusing claims that circulate online. So I thought this is interesting. Who will we find involved in this? And well, there's a whole list of them. So now we've suddenly got massive collaboration across the press and media. Just look at all those names. But did you spot the tiny partner?
You were too quick there, I didn't.
Good. Well, let's have a look. So this is Crosscheck. Who's involved? Crosscheck was devised and developed by First Draft and Google News Lab in consultation with newsroom partners across France. The project is a collaboration of news, education and technology partners. So I'm greatly encouraged to see that behind the BBC, we've now got Google News Labs, but they tell us that unfortunately they can never be sure if something is true or false.
Oh.
So that's a bit worrisome. But there we are. We've now got the global media coming together because they're so frightened of the power of social media. So cross-check one partner with the BBC. Let's have a look at the other. Here it is, First Draft News. It's dedicated to improving skills and standards in the reporting and sharing of information that emerges online. And I'm going to point out that within this collaboration, they are now sharing reporters and trainee reporters. So you may be CNN initially, but then you do a bit of work with the BBC. So we've got one global media network being created. So here's First Draft. It was launched in September 2016, the first of its kind to bring together the largest social platforms with global newsrooms. Human rights, it's all in here, Mike, we're safe. And I'll just highlight this. Here we are. It's a global collaboration of organisations.
Wow.
So, you know, I think we could pack up tomorrow, Mike, because we can trust the BBC working with Google News Labs and all these other agencies. So what can we add to that? Well, we better do this, really, because these are the supporters for First Draft News. And here's some more. So I thought we'd amalgamate this lot. So here they all are for the two organisations. And I think what we've been presented with here is a nice summation of the organisations we shouldn't trust.
That seems pretty definitive.
I think that more or less anybody that's joined this scam, we can say you don't want to trust a word they say. And Facebook's in there, of course. We've also got Full Fact is hidden away in there. BBC News, of course, shows Channel 4 News. So if you say who should we not trust at the moment, well, it's probably that little collection. And we'll just add this, that BBC Reality Check has been working extremely hard, because if we have a look at their website, we see that some days they don't manage to produce anything. So we've got a gap between the 9th and the 13th here, I think it is. And we've got 3.65 billion of BBC, which is unable to check even one piece of news per day.
Well, it must be that everything was real on those days.
Well, I didn't think about that. Mike, no, so we actually have days where there's no fake news at all. Yeah. This is good news,
yes.
Isn't it? Well, we'll add this one in because I couldn't resist this. Reality check. Did the government protect police funding? And I recognise the gentleman, the policing minister, Mr. Brandon Lewis. He said this government has protected police funding through the 2015 spending review. But the reality is, of course, that it's nothing to do with funding. The government protected the child abusers using the help of Brandon Lewis, who has simply failed to follow up on the Met Police whistleblower. But BBC Reality Check, of course, doesn't want to check the reality of child abuse.
No.
A little bit too worrisome for them.
Oh, OK, well, transformation then. Transformation is the order of the day. Let's start with this. Our mayor, your vote. So who's saying this? Government saying this. So the mayors that are about to be elected in May are their mayors. It is our vote. So, you know, we're going to be voting for them, but it's their mayors. And that's really important language, I think. It's very important to look at what they're saying about their own nonsense. So their mayors, and what's this about? They say on the 4th of May 2017, power is being put into the hands of local people. Is it? Because it's their mayors, not ours. Right? They say six regions in England will hold elections to elect new combined authority mayors. To find out what the combined authority mayoral elections in your region you might visit, well, they've got links to Cambridgeshire and Peterborough, Greater Manchester, Liverpool City Region, Tees Valley, West Midlands and West of England. They say that devolution is putting new and more power in the hands of local people. Local what? Local stooges? Local puppets?
Government representatives.
Government representatives, okay. By helping communities take control of decisions that matter to them, combined authority mayors will be accountable to the people they serve. Mayors will work across the regions to provide a louder voice for local people. They will act as ambassadors to bring together businesses, public service providers, communities to improve the productivity and prosperity of the area. Combined authority mayors will have control over new long-term budgets from central government. There'll be no strings attached. but they'll have control of those. Implement transport investment strategy planning, improve skills and invest in new homes, lobby on behalf of their area on the issues that matter to local people, not only in Westminster, but on the world stage, work with local business leaders to achieve the best for local jobs and the economy, capitalize on local strengths, like our universities, scientific research and innovation. So this all sounds really good, but you know, you might expect that we would have some really top class people standing for the elections as mayors, yeah?
Absolutely, upstanding people.
Well, today, one of those upstanding people, Andy Burnham, launched his manifesto to become mayor of Manchester. And he launched his manifesto with a soundtrack of Oasis, James and the Rolling Stones.
Right.
Right. So he's really taking this seriously. Now, Andy Burnham, of course, we've got to remember he was a member of the Health Select Committee 2001-2003. He was parliamentary private secretary to David Blunkett, Common Purpose, and then to Ruth Kelly. He was Home Office. He was responsible while he was at the Home Office then for implementing the Identity Cards Act. Well, that didn't go through, or did it? I can't remember. But anyway, he was promoted to Minister of State for the Department of Health. He then went to become Chief Secretary of the Treasury. He then went to become Secretary of State for Culture, Media, Sport. He then went back to the Department of Health as a Secretary of State. And he was Secretary of State during the inquiry, which was chaired by Robert Francis, into the Staffordshire hospital deaths. And of course, that was the inquiry that was kind of nobbled a bit, was it?
It was nobbled by the government putting a common purpose panel in place to rewrite the original report, Mike.
So that's Andy Burnham that was in charge of that. And he was also had a whole range of shadow posts under Ed Miliband. So this man, huge experience. He's obviously a fine, upstanding politician and would make a great mayor for Manchester. So we've got to applaud the fact that he has launched this manifesto. But sticking with transformation, let's move on to Jeremy Haywood, who, of course, is the head of the civil service. And he's saying that last May, he and John Manzoni wrote about the need to develop a stronger commercial function for government. And he's saying that 10 months on, much progress has been made and the Civil Service Board has agreed the next stage of the transformation programme. Now, of course, he's writing this in a sort of almost private blog for the civil service. Not many people read it, I'm sure. It's getting no coverage. This transformation agenda is getting no coverage in the mainstream media whatsoever. And, you know, we've got to ask what is going on. He says that this is very important because of the sheer scale of commercial activities that that central government and therefore the civil service is responsible for. We're a major customer for goods and services. Each year we spend £44 billion in external contracts. And to ensure value for money for the taxpayer and the best outcomes for users of the services, the civil service needs the best commercial skills to plan, procure and manage contracts. And you've got to ask, Brian, what the heck did they do for the last 300 years?
Well, before we had the transformation agenda and mindfulness, Mike, we couldn't do anything, really.
Right. He cites the Department for Work and Pensions, a fine, upstanding department, one of the best in the country, as now consulting on changes to their estate, having secured heads of terms for commercial deals on rents, saving facilities management costs, and they're expecting to save £180 million a year for the next decade. So let's put that in a bit of context. The interest that we pay on government debt is £50 billion a year. And through this transformation programme, they're going to save £180 million a year. So how much is this transformation programme costing? Okay, they're going to save a little bit of money, but how much is it costing, all this common purpose style training that they have to go through? It's really not a very significant return on the investment, as far as I can see. And so you've got to ask what's actually going on here. Is this the privatization of the civil service? I suspect it is. So he said, this involves policy advisors, commercial professionals working closely together. So we're suddenly seeing public and private being merged. To understand whether achieving policy goals requires outsourced services, significant new technology or property procurement, or the involvement of external parties in other ways. What other ways? Doesn't say. So this massive change agenda, transformation agenda, on the cards, whether it be devolution and the big society moving forward, or the complete privatisation of public services.
Well, these two are going hand in hand, aren't they? This is the key thing. Privatisation is part of the transformation agenda, but the other part of transformation agenda is the bringing together under one mindset. This is what mindfulness program is about, and this is what big society as a whole, it's going to control everything. Mm. I noticed that there's a slight similarity there with her flick with those glasses, Mike. I take it the nippy is not doing anything with this gentleman. Well,
no,
we'll move on.
Yeah.
Well, people are saying, what can we do about this? And the answer is exposure. We must educate ourselves. We must help other people in the UK understand what the government is actually doing. We are being attacked by the British government. This is the simple picture. 22nd of April, this beautiful hall in Nottingham has been made available by the British Constitution Group. It'll take nearly 950 people come together to exchange information, ideas and expertise, because we know there are a great many people out there doing wonderful things to challenge what's going on. But we need to bring those people together to help spread those ideas. So that's the hall. Tickets, £10. And today the programme is being released. You'll be able to get that via the British Constitution Group website. But the nub of this is not about set piece talks by the British Constitution Group. This is making that vast space available so that people can meet in groups, get together in groups in a very informal, relaxed way, and essentially swap ideas, teach each other about what is working and what's not, and above all, creating mutual support and friendships. So if you haven't already got a ticket, please do get one. We cannot guarantee that you will be able to get a ticket on the door on the day. So tickets are available through the website, and we advise you to do that as soon as you can. Now, I'm also going to say thank you very much to people who have subscribed to the UK column, and we've also had some donations in this morning. We had some very kind and generous donations given to us at the UK column meeting last night. Thank you very much, because this is what keeps us going. And don't watch the BBC News. Personally, I believe it's sort of dangerous for your health. Well, some good news, albeit I find this a very difficult subject here. This is Sergeant Alexander Blackman. A court has actually squashed his murder conviction because they've now said that he's guilty of manslaughter on grounds of diminished responsibility. I find that whole statement, diminished responsibility, this was a man fighting for his country in unbelievably violent and unpleasant situation. He did what he did. This is not unusual in times of war and conflict. Horrible things happen. But this man put in prison, not as an accident. This man has been put in prison by the British government. These are the same MPs that swan around having abused children or committed fraud or some other form of corruption.
And let's not mention Tony Blair, who actually should be in prison.
We won't mention Tony Blair, of course, the man who, I've asked this question, how many people would be alive if Tony Blair had not been Prime Minister? But Alexander Blackman may be released because of his time served, and I think he should be as soon as possible. Well, if we're imprisoning British veterans, something truly horrible is happening with Britain's police. This is an article from a couple of days ago. Thomas Orchard custody death. Three officers found not guilty of killing a man with schizophrenia in police custody. Now, this was a jury decision. But one of the questions I would like to ask is, what actually happened in that case? Was there any form of direction of the jury by the judge or others taking part? I don't know, but this seems to be an astonishing decision. What took place was that seven police officers held down this 5'7" man who was mentally ill. He was bound and trussed, and then effectively a gag put over his face so that he later asphyxiated and had a heart, effectively had a heart attack. So the CCTV footage of it here being restrained in police custody. Look at those policemen all in black, bald heads. I don't get a good feeling about this, but apparently none of those men had any common sense. Well, let's have a look at this report from devonlive.com because it's extremely interesting. It went in some to some detail. The picture is of the judge, Mrs. Justice Chima Grubb. But let's look at what this article said. It said earlier in the trial at Bristol Crown Court, Police Sergeant Kingshot said he heard Mr. Orchard threaten, "I'm going to bite your effing face off." The other officers recalled a bite threat. In summing up, the prosecution yesterday, Mark Haywood QC, said the officers had made up this threat in order to justify using the controversial emergency response belt. This was the item that was put across the gentleman's face. Mr. Haywood said claims made to investigators in the aftermath of the incident had been abandoned by the trio by the time they gave evidence under oath in court. "It might be a mistake in recollection or the fault of people asking questions," he told the jury. "It doesn't explain a diametrically wrong account advanced for the purposes of justification, but in precisely the same way. How is it that we've got three men present on the same day and they've all got the same thing wrong by means of an error in a way that fits one with the other?" He told the jury the three defendants had been tempted to mislead the investigators to justify applying the belt. And I think in that analysis by Devon Online there's some very accurate thought about what actually took place in that case. And I say, how did that jury return a verdict of not guilty? Mm. How did that happen? Now, one of the things that the British Constitution Group is pushing extremely hard for is that we should be abandoning court cases which are simply heard by magistrates. We should, or indeed single judges, we should be reintroducing jury trial wherever possible. But I would add alongside that, the key fact is that the juries are given that role knowing their full powers, which is that they can ultimately overturn law if they believe it is bad law. I have personally witnessed a court case in Portsmouth, where the judge directed the jury to find the person guilty, to the extent that the foreman and other members of the jury sat there with this amused look on their face because they clearly didn't understand what was going on in court. So we receive a lot of reports about juries being effectively directed by judges. Did that happen in this case? Well, this lady picked up on what was happening here. We retweeted this. Deborah Cole said, "A needless, shocking death of Thomas Orchard, a man in a mental health crisis. Police lost sight of him as a human being." And I think this is an extremely important statement. And of course, a UK column viewer picked up on this and said, "Is this the training? Is it the training that dehumanises them?" And I'm going to say, well, this takes us back to at least 10 years ago when UK column was warning about the influence of common purpose training inside the police. This is a joint meeting for Independent Commission on Good Governance, Mike, in public services. And here we can see Ian Blair, at the time Metropolitan Police Commissioner, sitting alongside other senior common purpose people. But it gets worse, because if we go to the College of Policing, the strategy here, who do we find? Well, it's this lady, Dame Shirley Pierce. And why are we so interested in her? Well, we've got, after graduating from St. Anne's College, Oxford University, with a degree in psychology, physiology and philosophy, Dame Shirley trained as a clinical psychologist, gaining an MPhil in clinical psychology from the Institute of Psychiatry in London. And then she's been in hospitals. Why do we need this lady, Mike? to be training the police?
I'm speechless.
It's fascinating, isn't it? So we're asking the question, if we've got any members of indeed Devon and Cornwall police or other police authorities in the country listening, perhaps you would help us out. Why do the police feel it is necessary to put a psychologist in charge of police training? And why do the police find it necessary to use neuro-linguistic programming in their training? Why do they find it necessary to employ common purpose to train police? And as our viewer asked, is it this training which is dehumanising Britain's police force?
So on the way home last night, Brian, the police car driving up at speed behind me with the lights flashing. And as I get further up the road, there are two police cars already there with lights flashing and six guys gathered around one elderly gentleman. And what could he possibly be doing? He was at the bottom of a footbridge. What could he possibly be doing that requires three police cars to attend and that kind of what was clearly bullying going on?
Right. Well, my comment to that is that many years ago, I was contacted by a lady who was married to a police officer. And what she said to me is that she had noticed the personality of her husband changing ever since he had done a police diversity course. And his behaviour became so strange that at a particular time, she said, I knew I had to leave this man. He'd got to the point of sitting, shouting at the television screen saying, you see those people, those are the people we've got to police. So she saw personality change from the loving man that she'd married to a rather brutalised, desensitised man. And this particular lady said, I believe this was down to the diversity training that that policeman went through in his particular police force. Now, I'll end on the subject of mindfulness, because much as I anticipated, having spoken out and warned that the government was unleashing a massive mindfulness program on the nation, in NHS, in justice, in commercial world, and of course in education, I have received some emails where people tell me this was outrageous. What a terrible thing to do, to criticise mindfulness. There are many excellent practitioners out there, and many people need mindfulness in order to help them through their lives. And my response to this is, of course, our report was that this was callous and very dangerous use of mindfulness by the British government. We started to expose the sheer scale of it. It is not enough to say that because you have a friend who is a very nice person, and they are doing very good work with these techniques, that what we are warning about doesn't have any credibility. So I will be responding to the people who've challenged me on this, but I'm going to say that UK Column is going to continue to warn of the use of what is essentially hypnosis, particularly on people who are not aware it's being used on them or their children. That's it for today. Thank you again for those donations that we've received over the last 48 hours. Exceptionally kind and much appreciated. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow. Bye-bye. Bye.